First, it's time for our weekly roundup of top stories from the nation's capital. President Trump and the intelligence and defense agencies of his administration are making a variety of statements in response to explosive reporting about the possibility of Russian bounties on the lives of American and allied soldiers in Afghanistan. We'll also look at some of the history of the Fraternal Order of Police's influence in Washington, and what is the Capitol expecting for this weekend's observance of the 4th of July. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Have you been following the twists and turns of the story of alleged Russian bounties? What would you like to have clarified? And what do you think this president or any president should or should not be briefed on from an intelligence standpoint? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Joining us this week is Amanda Turkel, Washington Bureau Chief for the Huffington Post. Amanda, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's lead off with this story that sounds something out of a political thriller, the Russian bounties. Different intelligence agencies, the Defense Department, Republicans and Democrats are all saying slightly different things about this alleged intelligence. Who has control of the narrative right now?
Well, if you listen to the Trump administration, or I should say the White House and President Trump himself, what's going on is that Trump didn't know anything about this. And if he did know anything about this, it's a hoax. That is what the administration is trying to get out there. But I don't think that they are winning that. They have invited members of Congress to the White House to try to make clear that this intelligence isn't as clear cut as it seems, that there are some discrepancies. There was some disagreement about how solid it was. I think that's an attempt to cover up the fact that the president didn't pay attention to the daily briefing he received in February. And this is a written document that presidents receive, that most presidents read, but President Trump doesn't, clearly.
And he said that himself.
Right. He said this. So they're trying to cover up the fact that this information, this important information, was put in front of him and he didn't read it and he didn't notice it. And so they're saying, look, the intelligence was never as clear as it seems. And they're trying to muddy the waters a little bit. But you have more news reports coming out that are more and more embarrassing for the president. You have some Republicans saying, like, look, this is a serious deal. We need to get to the bottom of this. That's not what you're hearing Trump say at all. You would think that you would be hearing him say, you know, even if there are some questions, I want to know more, and this is outrageous.
And I want to get back to that Republican response, but I do want to look a little bit at the Democrats. I believe, was it 8 Democrats were invited to the White House for a briefing yesterday? They've been calling for a briefing of the entire House of Representatives, but they were offered 8. But the briefing was not from military or intelligence representatives. They were really administration kind of office of the president type people. Instead, what does that say to us?
Right. This is a PR exercise. They're trying to do damage control rather than once again get to the bottom of this. If the White House were really concerned about it, you would see, I think, more of a press for, actual investigations and actual fact gathering. But the president himself has long been skeptical of the intelligence agency. He thinks that, you know, there's this deep state conspiracy to embarrass him. And he has called out the intelligence agency, often around the Russia impeachment matter with Ukraine. And so he has long been skeptical of the intelligence agency, which you're seeing coming out in this.
And let's talk about the Republicans. It has been the rare Republican on the rare instance that has gone against the Trump administration's kind of marching orders. What, if any, pushback are we seeing from members of the president's own party?
Well, I will say that a lot of Republicans are obviously backing the president up, as they usually do, saying that, you know, intelligence agencies often don't agree with each other. The initial reports were false. But you are seeing, you know, national security and being tough on Russia is something where Republicans have often tried to distinguish themselves, especially from Democrats. And so you are seeing Republicans here and there saying, like, you know, I'm concerned about what I'm hearing. I would like to know more about this. But the pushback, of course, has been fairly light because they're afraid of criticizing the president too much.
There are more developments coming out. I was going to say daily, but really it's probably closer to hourly. One of the latest is that there are, you know, they say follow the money. There is money, that large amounts of money that were transferred from basically the Russian security agency to known Taliban representatives. That's one of the most recent pieces of news. What, if anything, is going to ensure that this is an issue that actually gets looked at and gets taken seriously by members of both parties?
Well, I think that you'll see Democrats continuing to bring this up. You know, they control the House. They can call for investigations. Like you said, that there are news reports that continue to come out about this frequently, showing that, you know, this wasn't just a rogue intelligence analyst slipping something into the president's briefing. You know, that's not how this happened. Intelligence analysts had actual verifiable information that led them to believe that this is what was going on. And I think that you'll see more and more evidence come out about this as perhaps intelligence analysts are upset that what they were finding wasn't being taken more seriously. And you could, of course, have more families of service members speak out as well that they want answers.
We're about 4 months out from the 2020 presidential election, which in some ways seems like a long time away, and in other ways it seems like a blink of an eye. Do you see this issue as being one that, that carries over and influences that election?
If being honest, probably not. I think that a lot of people right now are not focused on foreign policy because we are in the middle of a pandemic still, and I think that you know, the economy, people's health and healthcare are still on the front of voters' minds. And rarely does national security and foreign policy dominate an election. So, you know, I think that this further gives ammunition to his critics, Trump's critics, and people who stand by him are more likely to believe him. So I think we're going to still hear more about the coronavirus, you know, as in the run up to November, unless something else you know, major happens. And with the way this year is going, who knows?
It is a new month after all. We're ready for a new crisis, right? We are talking right now with Amanda Turco, Washington Bureau Chief for the Huffington Post, taking a look at some of the biggest news stories out of the nation's capital this week. And Amanda, you wrote a very extensive article about the Fraternal Order of Police and their influence in the nation's capital. Police reform certainly is a huge issue on the most local of levels and on a national level. I definitely want to talk about the Fraternal Order of Police, but let's first touch on what is going on in Congress with police reform bills, because there seemed to be quite a bit of momentum and then it came to a screeching halt.
Yeah, I mean, basically, there's not a lot going on now. There was for a little while. Both the Senate and the House tried to pass legislation. And because the Senate is controlled by Republicans and the House is controlled by Democrats, neither chamber really liked the other's bill. And so in the Senate, you had Senator Tim Scott, who's the only Black senator in the Republican Party, lead the way on a piece of legislation that Democrats said didn't go far enough. It didn't ban the use of chokeholds and no-knock warrants by police. And it also, notably, did not get rid of this concept called qualified immunity, which basically makes it impossible to sue police for misconduct. And it really shields police. And it's something that's very important. We were talking about the Fraternal Order of Police, which is basically the largest police union in the country. It's very important to police unions. And it's something that most Republicans want to protect as well. The House legislation, which was led by Congresswoman Karen Bass, who's head of the Congressional Black Caucus, did go farther. It did ban all of those things. It did get rid of qualified immunity. And Republicans have said in the Senate that they're just not going to take it up. And so basically, it seems like, you know, I think there will be a few more attempts to come up with legislation, but it doesn't seem like police reform is really going to go anywhere this session.
Well, and it's interesting because in your piece, you talk about how for many, many years, it was very dangerous politically to not be seen as pro-police, pro-law enforcement, and that it could really affect your chances of being reelected, for instance, to whatever post you were holding. In this moment that we are living, that seems like it's not the given it used to be, but there is still this very powerful lobbying group called the Fraternal Order of Police. Can you tell us briefly what kind of power they wielded, say 2019 and before, since 2020 has been a very different year?
Yes, I mean, they have allies on both sides, obviously. So they're very allied now with Donald Trump, and they have generally endorsed Republicans for president, with the exception of Bill Clinton. But, you know, they do have, you know, Senator Patrick Leahy from Vermont is one of their biggest champions on Capitol Hill. But, you know, Democrats and Republicans, you know, especially at the local level, if you're running for mayor or something like that, you want the endorsement of police unions. You want to be seen as someone who's going to, you know, hold up law and order, who is on the side of police. I think now a lot more candidates are questioning that. And I've talked to Democratic strategists who are saying that their candidates are looking at whether they really want those endorsements. If they get the endorsement of a police union, are they going to tout it in a press release? Are they going to go seeking out those endorsements? That's not as obvious an answer as it used to be. And so the Fraternal Order of Police, you know, basically they could scare politicians into, you know, if you don't support what we're on, we're going to say you're anti-police. And that seemed to be scary enough for politicians in the past, whether or not it was a real threat, that they often went along with what the Fraternal Order of Police wanted. And like you said, I think now people are starting to question that more and are pushing back a little bit, saying we want to see more reform. And the FOP and these other police unions are often standing in the way of that.
I found it really interesting in your very lengthy piece about the Fraternal Order of Police that you likened their stances and the way they approach lobbying as very similar to that of the NRA, in that, you know, it's very much a, if you give them an inch, they'll take a mile. And so they have historically been extremely resistant to any kind of reforms because they see it as such a slippery slope. Do you get any sense from the Fraternal Order of Police that they might see some advantage in softening some of their stances and at least giving the impression that they're willing to work on these issues?
They're giving the impression that they are, yes. you know, they have already said that they're open to banning chokeholds. But that seems to be something that's sort of easy for them to give up because a lot of you know, a lot of codes of conduct already ban chokeholds. Some law enforcement office organizations don't, but for the most part, that's already something that's seen as taboo. So they can say, yeah, you know, we're against that. They said, came out very, very hard and said, we oppose getting rid of qualified immunity. We don't like creating a national registry, for example, of police officers so that you can see their misconduct records everywhere, no matter where you are. And that prevents hiring a bad cop, you know, someone who is a bad cop in one department, hiring them in another state, for example. They're against that. So I think they are doing things that make it look like they're trying to be sort of good cooperative players, but they're still standing firm. And, you know, like the NRA, they represent the extreme. They tend to be more conservative. Their organization is very, at the top, very heavily white male. And there are other police organizations that represent more officers of color who don't take such an extreme hardline stand as the FOP and some of these other unions.
We're talking with HuffPost Washington Bureau Chief Amanda Turkle about some of the biggest stories out of the nation's capital this week. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the influence of police unions as a special interest group in Washington? Would you judge a politician on whether they had a favorable or unfavorable mark from one of those groups? And we want to hear what you would like to see Congress do about police reform. Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll pick up the conversation after a short break here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. We're continuing our talk now about the week in Washington news with HuffPost Washington Bureau Chief Amanda Turkle. And Amanda, I want to turn to the topic of Washington, D.C. statehood. Statehood and the ability to end the period of, quote, taxation without representation has long been just a dream for residents of the District of Columbia. But the House of Representatives actually approved a bill granting it. But there are a lot of obstacles. Take us through what the process is.
Right. So, I mean, it's the first time that the House in the 219-year history of Washington, D.C., it's the first time that either chamber of Congress has ever approved D.C. becoming a state. And it's not going to go anywhere because you have President Trump in office. He is not going in the White House. He's not going to sign this. He's made that very clear. And he's made clear it's political because D.C. is very, very Democratic and he doesn't want to give he doesn't want more Democrats in Congress. And then you have the Senate, which is obviously also controlled by Republicans. So for now, it's not going anywhere. And it really hinges on Democrats retaking control of the White House and the Senate in the next Congress in order to get this going and obviously to retain control in the House. And you probably need a filibuster-proof majority, so 60 Democratic senators in the Senate. So it has a very steep climb. But for a lot of people, in D.C., that this was symbolic, and this was shown, you know, this sort of showed how far the Democratic Party has moved over time. You know, there was a time when not even all Democrats supported this because you had a lot of Southern Democrats, and the politics of not giving D.C., you know, representation in Congress was really racist. To be quite honest, and it was because a lot of freed blacks after slavery came to the district. The population was heavily African American, and that spurred the federal government to get rid of the city's elected government. And so, you know, the reason that DC doesn't have representation has a pretty ugly past.
Let's take a listen to Democratic Representative Maxine Waters speaking in support of the bill.
Washington, D.C. is the home to more Americans than two states, and more than 46% of its 700,000 residents are black. Make no mistake, race underlies every argument against D.C. statehood, and denying its citizens equal participation and representation is a racial, democratic, and economic injustice we cannot tolerate.
So, Amanda, very much what you were saying and what I think is especially important is that this is happening now. As you said, it's the first time that there's been a positive vote on this. And given the backdrop of Black Lives Matter, of the violence that is going on and being protested against, it seems like there's a very clear connection between the two.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, interest in this was revived when Trump sent federal forces into the streets of D.C. during the protests. He couldn't do that in other states because the governors control the National Guard. But in D.C., he was allowed to do that. And so that, you know, obviously made a lot of people in D.C. upset. And people started, you know, once again, talking about statehood. And, you know, it's, you know, The Congress and has often stepped in D.C.'s affairs, you know, beyond just Trump now sending federal forces in. You know, they have tried to block laws passed by D.C.'s elected government, blocking abortion funds in the 80s, domestic partnership benefits for same-sex couples in 1992, clean needle exchanges in 96, the legalization of marijuana in 2014. And every time D.C. passes some major legislation affecting the city, you have Congress often stepping in, especially when it's controlled by Republicans, stepping in and trying to stop it, even though, you know, these lawmakers don't live here and don't, you know, aren't represented by these lawmakers.
Well, in an interesting kind of addition to that issue, the 4th of July is this weekend. Obviously, as the nation's capital, there are often huge festivities. And last year, President Trump held what was seen as a rally of sorts in Washington, D.C. There's a lot going on right now that makes 2020 different, not least of which is the pandemic. What are we expecting in terms of the 4th of July events in the capital this year?
Well, the D.C. mayor, Muriel Bowser, who is a Democrat, canceled the 4th of July parade. There will be fireworks still. Trump and the First Lady will still be doing, sort of a little speech rally type thing from the White House. And the National Mall will be open if people do want to go down and see fireworks. The mayor is advising people to stay home, to not come out, to watch the fireworks from their house or from somewhere at a safe distance, while the White House and the president are, say they want a repeat of years past. They want people down there. They want it to be a show of support for the president, basically. I don't know what we're going to see yet. I don't think it will be like years past, especially if people are aware that Trump wants them to come out, especially because DC residents aren't super fond of Trump because it is such a Democratic city. But the question is, will people be coming in from other cities? DC typically attracts a big national crowd on the 4th of July. And I don't know how many people will be traveling here with, the coronavirus spike in other parts of the country and all the travel sort of hesitations people have.
Well, Amanda, always a pleasure to talk with you and to have you with us.
Great. Thank you for having me.
That's Amanda Turkle, Washington Bureau Chief for HuffPost. We talked with her about some of the top stories coming out of Washington this week that included the efforts in both the Senate and the House to have police reform legislation that would be agreeable to both parties. We also talked about the developments in the story about bounties allegedly being paid by Russia to the Taliban to kill U.S. and allied forces. And we also talked about the issue of D.C. state hood, what it would give those residents, and why there would be opposition from Republicans in the Senate and also the Trump administration itself.